Hello, guys, gals, non-binary pals, unnecessary NPCs, and other. Welcome to the Sci-Fi Lab. I'm your host, DJ Squared, and with me is my special guest,
Andrew Shepherd.
Yep, and today, Andrew has, he's decided to grace the lab with his presence, and we're happy to have him here. Unfortunately, my usual co-host, Harper, could not be here because she has either been taken by pod people or is running a very high fever. Get better soon, Harper. Okay, so what we generally start off with is what was your very first experience with science fiction? Like, first piece of media you ever really sort of consumed?
I'm gonna probably say, I'd have to say Star Wars, probably. I mean, I guess it's a cliche one, but but I remember being about 4 or 5 years old and seeing the Star Wars movies and getting the Empire and being really worried about Han.
So you were devastated by the newest by the newer movies.
Yeah. and being really upset on Luke's behalf about the whole Vader thing. So, like, yeah.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with a sort of cliche beginning.
Yeah.
As anybody who has listened to the first episode knows, mine was not really all that cliche, especially considering my age.
Yeah.
Because my first experience with science fiction was Forbidden Planet.
Wow.
Actually, yeah. My dad's was an old school, sci-fi nerd, so that's the one I remember.
That's a pretty good introduction, though.
Yeah. I mean, we both sort of got like the whole space opera type deal.
Yeah.
So that's fun times. I'm pretty sure Harper said hers was Stargate. If it wasn't Stargate, then that's the only one I remember because
as
she talks about
or the original Roland Emmerich one.
I don't remember. She talks about Stargate the series frequently. So it might have been that, or I might be completely off base and remembering entirely wrong. That was a season ago.
Yeah. Huh.
Obviously, I need to go back and listen to the older Sci-Fi Lab episodes. All right. So you had the original Star Wars experience from a very small age.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be part of the generation that could see Empire unspoiled. Like, nice. I mean, I didn't see it in the theater. I wasn't born yet, but
close enough.
Yeah,
close enough.
I was young enough to be sucker punched by that. So,
cool. I mean, like, plenty of people who are much older than you were sucker punched by it too.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh gosh, those formative years.
Yeah,
you learned not to trust very quickly. Oh dear. Okay, so you're a science fiction grad, like, researcher?
Yes.
And is that what that's what you're doing your, like, grad student work on, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm a PhD candidate in English literature with a genre fiction focus. So I work on science fiction, fantasy, horror. I also do crime fiction, spy fiction. Basically, I do, like, all the stuff that people typically read for fun. I actually sort of try, I'm the contrarian who likes to be analytical about that stuff. Because I actually do think it's pretty important to think critically about the things that we consume for entertainment purposes.
The question, where are all the black people in Harry Potter?
That's a very good question. Now we have Zoe Kravitz in Fantastic Beasts, the new one, but yeah, for a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't really have any black folk in Harry Potter.
Or at least none with, like, major roles.
Yeah. I mean, now they've sort of, now J.K. Rowling has hedged and said, well, Hermione could have been black. I'm like, yeah, but she probably wasn't conceived that way.
It's like, yeah, but you probably... I actually heard a theory recently that... I'm not sure if it's as much of a theory as it is a rumor that Hermione was based off of J.K. herself.
Mm.
So...
That wouldn't shock me.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people see themselves in Hermione, so.
Yeah.
So you're, that's just what you do, you just sort of, like, pick at it, see?
I mean, it comes from a place of love,
Well, obviously.
Yeah, but yeah, I sort of I think as a critic, my bent is more historicist. So a lot of it is providing context for things. So like if you're thinking about, I'm reminded of a Neil Gaiman quote. I think this is from the introduction to The Star Is My Destination. But he sort of says that nothing dates faster than the future. And like, yeah, you look at that book in particular, and it's a very 1950s view of what the 24th century might be like. It's very concerned with 1950s anxieties. There's a super weapon called Pyre that's basically exponentially worse than than the atomic bomb, because the atomic bomb had just been dropped 10 years ago. There's a sort of interplanetary cold war between the inner rim worlds, that's like Earth and Mars and the moon, and like the worlds on the other side of the asteroid belt, so like the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and so basically it's a cold war, and you see a lot of that sort of anxiety of, are we explorers or are we warriors? Are we going to sort of wipe ourselves out with technology, or are we going to use our sort of our curiosity and our intellectual sort of drive to sort of take us to new places and sort of circumvent that sort of negative sort of outlook on sort of human ingenuity? And so like that those seem like, I mean, it still holds up well today, but when you read that book, it really does feel like this is obviously a guy writing in the 1950s looking at what was going on. And maybe not that, I mean, you know, it can be said if this goes on, but it's really sort of, you know, it's using the future to estrange us from stuff that's going on in the 1950s,
I would say. To like examine the current day.
Exactly.
It's a lot easier to look at a situation when you take a few steps back.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I do like seeing sort of the timeline of how things evolve.
Yeah.
How you're thinking about things like that. So I'm interested.
Cool. Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. You do have at least some audience for awesome. Your stuff.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, so one of the things I do is thinking about science fiction as a megatext, as they say. That is to say that one of the things, I mean, I guess in a sense, all literature sort of refers back to earlier forms of literature. But science fiction is particularly sort of, has always been particularly sort of self-aware and sort of about that tendency. Like, I mean, they're constant sort of Easter eggs referring back to other texts. So like basically, so in James Tiptree Jr.'s The Girl Who Was Plugged In, which was published, I want to say, in 1973, was written in 1968, she refers to the main character's so the main character is born into a deformed body, and her consciousness is projected into a body that was cloned in a placental decanter. And they refer to it as a body Waldo. And so that term is a reference back to an earlier Robert Heinlein story, where he refers to, is it Waldo Incorporated? I think. But basically, it becomes a sort of touchstone for prostheses or stories about stories about disability, basically the technology that sort of enables people to get past these disabilities or to compensate for these disabilities become referred to as Waldos. And so like there's this sort of lineage that gets established there. You get like sort of notions like parabolas of science fiction, that is to say these sort of complex sort of scenarios that are a combination of settings and particular time periods and stock characters that populate those particular settings in those time periods, and like the types of tropes that sort of accrue with them. So like space opera would be an example of a parabola that's like a specific sort of story trajectory that we're familiar with. And so once that's been sort of established. Then basically on a certain level, we start to fill in the blanks. So there's like a lot less work that needs to be, groundwork that needs to be done to establish that stuff for you to sort of recognize the tropes and then sort of recognize how the authors are riffing on them.
Yeah. So like once a story type has been established, it's much easier to just completely turn it on its head.
Exactly that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's always fun.
Yeah.
Like, especially when it's done right. I mean, parody is truly a great art.
Yeah. I mean, parody or subversion or even just sort of like, just sort of tweaking it. Like, sometimes it's just sort of
alternate
simply like,
universe fan fiction. We're talking about you.
Yeah. I mean, also just sort of like, say someone makes a point of, like, a good example would be like of uses of the science fiction megatext. When robots are first introduced in science fiction, they're not mechanical. Like the first time a robot is used, it's in the term robot is used anyway. There were artificial life forms that show up earlier. But the first time the term robot is coined is in, I want to say 1920 in RUR, Karel Capek. It's a...
Wasn't it like an opera?
It's a play. Okay. And it's basically the word is coined from robota, which is a Polish word, which means, is it Polish or Czech? Don't remember. But
somewhere in there. Like northeastern Europe.
Yeah. But it means worker. And basically they were originally sort of more organic. They were grown. Karel Capek was Czech, I recall.
Okay. So they're more, like they started out more like the Jewish golem.
Right.
Than what we would think of as like an android or something.
Right. And so you go to like, say, a few decades later and you get Asimov's robot stories, which really sort of shape the way we see robots now. And we sort of, he introduces the notion of the positronic brain. Like the idea of like a being that's been literally programmed to serve your wishes. And then basically the rules of robotics, like, you know, essentially don't harm organic beings, etc. And then other people sort of take that idea and they run with it and they sort of push it to its breaking points, or they say, hey, like, I have issues with how this sort of plays out in Asimov's stories. So they write their own stories that are sort of riffing on and responding to it. And then like, sometimes they loop back around. So like if you're familiar with Dollhouse, what's the name of the corporation that sort of is behind the dollhouses? It's Rossum. And you've got organic beings who are turned into robots, like more or less, like essentially slave labor. And sort of, so that's like Joss Whedon and Jed Whedon and Marissa Chancharoen sort of going back and commenting on like, their text's relationship to this earlier text that came out like 100 years ago.
So like, maybe. Okay, I had a thought, and then I was just like, wait, does that actually count, or am I just like, completely, because like you were talking about how, like the purpose of a robot was to, you know, help and serve organic beings or whatever. It's like, so would the Matrix count as a complete reversal? Because technically the human beings are serving the robots, yeah, but more as like a battery and less as like an actual servant.
Well, I mean, if you think about where the Matrix starts, it starts at sort of the end of a familiar sort of story trajectory, which is to say the robot rebellion. It's just a robot rebellion where we definitively lost.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
So, like, you think about, like, robot rebellion stories. And, like, you know, Asimov has one. And then, like, basically you get, like, say something like, I have no mouth and I'm a scream. Where, like, you want to talk scary-ass robots? That's a scary-ass robot. Or AI. But, like, that one puts Skynet to shame.
Yikes.
But, yeah.
may I just go on the record as saying, yikes.
But, yeah, it's funny because in the video game based on the story, Harlan Ellison does the voice. It's just kind of awesome. That game's awesome for a lot of reasons. one being it's one of the first experiments with interactive narrative, and science fiction specifically being used in that context. But it's also, yeah, it's just great hearing Harlan Ellison do the voice of this truly malevolent AI. But
yeah,
like,
I know Lisa keeps like telling her classes, you gotta play this game. Like, it will give you nightmares. It's terrible. You've gotta play it.
Yeah, it's totally worth it. But yeah, like thinking about sort of robot rebellions and like and rebellious AIs, like usually we win those stories. Sometimes like barely, but like thinking about like, say, all right, so we've got I Have No Mouth and I'm a Scream, Battlestar Galactica, which sort of is riffing, it's also a space opera. It was very much sort of like Glenn Larson riffing on Star Wars, which had come out the year before. But it's sort of pretty much like the robots are the villains. We're the heroes. Like there's not a whole lot of gray in there. It's a pretty unambiguous sort of take on that. And like fast forward to 2004 with the reboot, they're doing a very different riff on that story. But like, yeah, thinking about The Matrix is sort of taking that familiar trope and then it's basically starting off in a scenario where the war already happened. That's sort of like the backstory. We lost. We don't even realize we've lost because basically things have gone on for so long with us in the VR scenario that like all this is sort of all this is forgotten essentially. So like the big shock reveal is the sort of underneath this sort of this virtual reality, this sort of conspiracy plot of like what's actually going on like in this reality. We find out about this sort of long backstory about our relationship to the artificial intelligences, to the robots. So I think I might have gotten off track, but
it's fine. We always do that here at the Sci-Fi Lab.
Yeah. But yeah, like, huh.
It might be the alien brain weasels. We're not sure yet.
But yeah, I mean, I think it is kind of engaged with that earlier tradition of stories about robots being created as workers, because that was one of the sort of things when we go back to the Animatrix stuff. We get a little bit more information about the war with the machines, and like basically it starts off where it starts off the way a lot of wars with the war with the machine trope plays out in science fiction narrative. That is to say, we created them to be our servants. They turned out to be we sort of made them intelligent so that they would be better at doing that type of work for us. And, you know, they had the reaction that most intelligent beings do when you basically sort of, you know, subjugate them and oppress them.
When you create them for slavery?
Yeah, when you create them for slavery. Turns out they don't like it much. Like, so there you go.
What a thunk.
Yeah.
No. Which is, that's also kind of interesting from like, sort of from like a biological standpoint. I sort of want to see like a riff on this. But it's like, we make hyper-intelligent dogs. Because the thing is, like, we genetically engineered dogs to serve us.
Yeah, true.
And then if we just made them a bit more intelligent, would there be a dog uprising?
I believe the second episode of Rick and Morty does that.
Huh.
Yeah.
I've seen, like, 10 minutes of Rick and Morty. Yeah. I don't know what show it is.
Yeah, they make the dogs like they make Morty's dog super intelligent, and like the first thing the dog basically asks is, where are my testicles?
Nice.
And then it goes from there.
Nice.
But yeah, there was also a Clifford Simak story about a future in which the human race has pretty much gone extinct, and what's the people who have succeeded us are super intelligent dogs who basically have their own sort of community and are telling stories about like the old days where there were humans.
It's like us. I feel like dogs talking about humans would be like us talking about fairies. You know, they're basically immortal. They're rather unknowable, very tall.
Yeah.
Tall, pale, kind of scary, lives forever as far as we're concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Oh, also, I mean, that sort of longevity that we have over them. Yeah, that would be sort of, I guess, yeah, that would be a weird thing for them.
Yeah, because if, like, they have the hyperintelligence, but they still live, like, 8 years.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah, I mean, also, like, I remember reading something that dogs would think us profoundly sort of disabled if they knew how limited our sense of smell was. But at the same time, they probably would be mystified by the amount of the sort of sheer color spectrum that we'd see.
Yeah.
So, it's kind of interesting thinking about, like just even ontologically how, like, hyper-intelligent dogs would view the world. But, yeah, huh.
Mostly in sepia tone.
Yeah, pretty much that. Oh, Court Wainer Smith does some stuff with races of animals that have been sort of more or less evolved up to sapient and humanoid status. In his so he has this large this expansive future history sort of mythology that are referred to as the instrumentality of mankind stories. And a significant portion of that is devoted to, like, the rise of the underpeople, so.
Are the underpeople analogous to the mole people, or is that just sort of a name you went with?
I mean, they're basically, like, you know, humanoid animals, pretty
okay.
much.
Okay, mole men. Mole men,
yeah.
Are real guys.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's one of the things. One of my favorite, like, emerging genres of science fiction is, like, it's grown up on the internet. Don't know if you've seen any of these. They're sort of collectively known as humans are weird stories. Huh. It's where you look at human and alien interactions from the perspective of the alien, so that we're the strange one. Like, we're these weird talking flesh bags that don't have, you know, whatever, don't have exoskeletons, don't have, like, a hive mind,
yeah.
Don't have wings or feathers or, like, a lot of fur. And it's fascinating.
Huh. That is kind of a cool idea, yeah.
I can send you some, like, links if you would like.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'd love to see that.
There's also a anthology that was printed, I think you can find it on Amazon, called Humans Wanted. And it's just an anthology of all of these little short stories of, like the basic premise of the entire genre is that aliens, both, like, different types of aliens have different opinions when it comes to humans. Like, some of them think that we're, you know, stupid, some think we're dangerous, some think that we're, like, basic, that we're, like, from a death planet, space orcs.
Yeah.
That we're useful, that we're very straight-laced, that we're reckless. And all of these things encapsulate, you know, humanity.
Yeah.
And they're just sort of exploring that from an outside perspective.
Huh.
It's absolutely fascinating. And yeah. Also largely hilarious.
Yeah, no, I mean, humans do a lot of really strange things when, like, I mean, mm-hmm. if you view us from, like, that sort of distance where we actually sort of, like, think about, like, yeah, I mean, even just, as you mentioned, like, selectively breeding other animals to be useful to us.
Yep.
That's weird. Like, I mean, that is a science fiction premise. I mean,
yeah.
For that matter, we did it to other humans, too. It was called slavery.
Yeah, it was called slavery.
Yeah, so, like, you know, and that, I mean, other, like, I'm not the first person to make this observation, but even, like, the history of slavery and the history of, like, say, Black people crossing the Middle Passage, like, is fundamentally a science fictional story. You know, like,
yeah.
Think about, like, the idea of, like, invaders from a foreign land in strange ships show up. They are technologically advanced. They take you across an ocean in their strange vessels to a new land with all sorts of strange flora and fauna that you would be previously unfamiliar with. They take away your language. They force you to participate in selective breeding programs that produce hybrid offspring. and you're sort of essentially sort of put to work in camps.
You're put to work and you're treated as property, and you might very well die of some strange disease that you've never seen before.
I mean, yeah, when you think about it, like, it's like, I mean, and Greg Tate mentions this in an interview with Mark Deary, in the essay Black to the Future. It's in an anthology called Flame Wars. But he essentially puts it this way, that black people live the estrangement that science fiction writers imagine. And, I mean, it you can make a convincing argument for that. Like, I mean, I remember reading that for the first time and going, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like,
you're just sitting here going, oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, also one of my very, very favorites of the humans are weird things, the premise starts out that, yeah, aliens came, they took over Earth, they, like, you know, rounded up all of the humans. Like, they were expecting armed resistance. They weren't expecting bears. So, because we've got all of this, like, really, really dangerous fauna.
Yeah.
That, like, aliens would not be equipped to deal with, especially if they were, like, I don't know if they looked like just giant bugs or something. Would not be able to deal with, like, the different climates, various flora and or fauna. So yeah. It's just like that one is just like a bunch of just little snippets of aliens having to deal with various
Earth so basically animals. Earth is Australia to
Earth is the rest th- of the is galaxy. Space Australia. Yeah, that is actually kind of like a tag on Tumblr. Earth is Space Australia.
Yeah.
And then they go to actual Australia and the aliens dealing with a cassowary. I think the ones I remember the most are the aliens had to deal with bears, a moose, skunk.
Oh, yeah.
Where they had to deal with the smell. Jaguars, tiger, honey badger, cassowary, hippopotamus. You know, all of these, like, super dangerous things. And then, like, once there was enough of those stories, they, like, shifted back to, like, the human settlements. And they like, go into a human settlement to, like, recruit more, or, recruit forcibly, yeah. Recruit more humans to help them, like, conquer the landscape. They could go into this person's house and are immediately attacked by their house cat. And they're just like, why do you have this tiny apex predator in your home?
Yeah.
It's just like, we're friends.
Yeah.
This is my butt. There's also the fact that humans will pet literally anything.
It's true.
You look at this giant cat, like this big old like lion, and you want to pet it. It looks fluffy. It will rip your face off. But that doesn't stop the urge. Another different subset of those stories is that when you have a human on an alien spaceship, you need to give them some sort of like pet, some sort of companion, because if not, they will try to take any alien animal that seems even like mildly friendly.
Yeah.
Like you've got this like 12 foot tall, really furry, like mammoth looking thing, and the human's just like, can we keep it? I've already named him. His name is George.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because like there's all especially in like the 60s and the 70s, there's like all sorts of stories about humans just finding like space animals that they can domesticate. Like I'm thinking like Debbie the Bloop from like the 1960s Lost in Space, which is like, you know, basically they took a chimpanzee and they put like fuzzy ears on it.
Yeah.
And like basically it's like, yeah, you know, Penny has a friend. She's a bloop. And like that's basically it's like, yeah, you know, like they find a lot of like fauna on these worlds that are surprisingly similar to like stuff that evolved on Earth. It's funny that, but yeah, it's just sort of amusing. Like in
humans' first instinct when faced with cute things is to hold them and or domesticate them.
Yeah,
like if it scans as non-toxic, we will probably pet it.
Pet it or eat it.
Pet it or eat it. Or both.
Or both.
It happens sometimes. Like, listen, cows are adorable. That doesn't stop a burger from being tasty.
Yeah.
Just angered any and all vegans in the audience.
But yeah, huh. I mean, sort of thinking about the, like thinking about humans are strange and like as a speculative trope, it makes me think of At the Mountains of Madness by Lovecraft, where you find out the sort of the origin of the human race, and it turns out there was a race of beings that essentially bred us as more or less livestock, like we were food. And so like basically like cataclysms happen as they do. And so they've been sort of more or less frozen in suspended animation in their like sort of hidden city in Antarctica for millions and millions of years. And so basically they come upon us like wearing clothes and talking and like basically brandishing tools and
living in cities
and living in cities. And like basically they're like, we don't exactly get it vocalized from their point of view, but you get the impression that, you know, this is a weird experience for them too, because imagine like basically you go to sleep for a few thousand million years, you wake up and chickens run things,
or like sheep.
Or sheep.
they
yeah, like imagine they're walking upright, they wear clothes, they have languages and they have cars and they have cities, or and basically
they have, you know, WMDs.
They have WMDs and they want to interact with you as equals. How weird would that be? It's like, yeah, it's like viewed from the old ones' perspective, it's like, yeah, that's totally weird. But yeah, it's like it's one of those sort of funny things for, like, I mean, it's it, like, well, I thought it was amusing anyway. I mean, it's it's played very much for horror, but like, you know, but it's one of those things that really, I think that was the exact moment where I became a Lovecraft fan, was just thinking about the weirdness of that. Like, and the weirdness, not only from the human's perspectives of finding out this, like, decidedly not flattering origin for the species, but like, you know, thinking about it, it's like, yeah, from the old one's perspective, this is just like, this is also a weird science fictional premise. So
it's like both races are looking at each other going, that's not right.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. It's so good. Oh dear. All right, so we're probably going to wrap this up soon. Do like one more question / info dump
session, yeah, sure.
You know, whatever. How about, what's your like guilty pleasure media? Like, it doesn't have to be science fiction, but like, just like, it would be better thematically if it was, but don't limit yourself.
Okay.
Science fiction, fantasy, you know, horror.
So what's my sort of guilty pleasure, or?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I mean...
Or just something that, like, you really, really love and no one would expect.
Really, really love and no one would expect. Huh. I don't know, because I'm pretty open about, like, all the things that I nerd out about.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good way to be.
Yeah, like, I mean, like...
Like, everyone knows that I'm an anime nerd.
Yeah, like, I mean, most people know about my various genre loves and my love of comics. Like, just about anything superhero related. Well, not anything. I mean, I do have some standards.
But, what, you're not a fan of Snowflame?
Is that a thing?
Snowflame is actually a villain from a comic book about cyborg animals. And he got his fire and ice powers by doing so much cocaine, he developed superpowers.
Oh, that just sounds kind of awesome. Like, I'll totally read that. So, yeah, no, I'm down for that. But
this is We interrupt your programming to let you know that doing a lot of cocaine will not give you superpowers.
Yeah,
it will make you super dead. But in this particular instance, it's hilarious. I mean, you have to, specifically in the context of this comic book, I can't remember what it's called, but I would know it if I like saw the cover, because it's a bunch of cyborg animals, or a bunch of animals that like hyper-intelligent animals that are in mech suits. There's like a dolphin and a gorilla and
wow.
Other things.
Okay.
But you kind of have to wonder if the entire premise is actually just Snowflame's really bad trip before he dies.
It's like a
dude's got fire and ice powers. He's fighting hyper intelligent animals in mech suits. Like, come on.
Yeah, it's like an occurrence of Owl Creek Bridge, but like just. You know, with giant mecha animals and lots of cocaine, basically.
I mean, you know, okay, we've gotten off topic anyway.
We are way off topic. We are in uncharted territory.
I shouldn't have mentioned Snowflame, but
yeah,
we're gonna get. Let's get back around. All right, so since you don't really have any guilty pleasures, what about just recommendations for the audience?
Ooh, recommendations. As far as fantasy stuff, everyone talks about Tolkien as like the great British fantasy author of the early 20th century, and Tolkien's awesome. I'm gonna recommend another author who is working around the same time, who had very different influences and took fantasy in a different direction, and that's Mervyn Peake, the Gormenghast novels. So sadly, he never got to finish them. They were intended to be a septology. He got through three of them, and his wife finished the fourth posthumously after he died. But they're awesome. They're fascinating. They're kind of, if Tolkien is riffing on like sort of medieval Europe as a sort of fictionalized chronotope and ripping on like, you know, sort of Nordic sagas and like sort of Northern European mythology in general, Mervyn Peake is sort of taking the Gothic and like the novel of manners, and he's turning it into like this jumping off point for fantasy stories. And so like basically it's set in this secondary world setting where pretty much it's this giant castle where
like
this
the
is
whole world
not well no not the entire world but like most
That'd
of the world
awesome
that would be awesome, but like for all intents and purposes the castle might as well be the world. For the first two books, the castle is most of what you see, and there's this very entrenched class system where basically you've got the Earl of Gormenghast Castle, and I believe the main character is like the 990-something Earl. And it starts on his first birthday, like literally the day he's born. The first book is the first year of his life. And so so the main character of the first book is not the actual hero of the entire series. It's the villain. It's a guy named Steerpike, who is... he is an albino hunchback who works in the kitchen, and he's this kind of revolutionary figure. In some ways, he's a very sort of like he's a figure that's sort of reminiscent of the Miltonian Satan, in that he's this guy who he wants to sort of overturn the apple cart. He wants to sort of upend the society, and he's charismatic. Like people tend to fall in love with him fairly easily. He's like he's kind of charming, like he's seductive to the reader, to the reader. This character's pretty compelling. He's played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, I think, in like the TV miniseries version of this. So like they basically he's got quite a bit of a fan base. This was like Tom Hiddleston's Loki before, like
nice
before he existed, basically. But. Sort of, it's kind of interesting how it's sort of dealing with, like, the notion of tradition and the encroachment of modernity, like, the sort of, the notion of class, Aristocracy and revolution, a lot of the sort of tumultuous things that are going on in the early 20th century, like thinking about like modernity as it's like as a sociological phenomena, like technological modernity, like the world becoming a smaller place, state traditions sort of eroding and making way for new ones, and how traumatic that would be for people. What's kind of interesting is that the first two books are set in and around Gormenghast Castle for the most part. And then the third book tends to weird people out because it's all of a sudden it's set in the city. And it feels like an industrializing city. A lot of people say that the third book isn't as good. And I think, well, it feels like an outlier partially because it's so different from what preceded it. And so it's interesting to think about generically that way. And it's an interesting case for a fantasy novel because while it is a fantastical setting, a lot of the sort of traditional tropes of fantasy that we think of aren't there. Like, so there are no like sort of magical creatures there's no magic. It's just sort of like this like really complex world building. With illustrations by the author himself. And so that's it's been an influence on a lot of authors. When you talk, when you look at like Michael Moorcock, he's claimed it as an influence. I would say Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman's readapting the novels for the screen. I think he's still doing that. But like you look at something
Neil Gaiman's
like,
doing a lot of things right now.
He really
now,
is.
You know?
Like, I don't know how he has the time, but. Yeah, this is, you look at Neverwhere, and like Neverwhere is hugely indebted to Gormenghast. Like there's this sort of lineage of, I would say, mostly British, but also American authors who sort of are drawing more upon that tradition than say, probably Tolkien. And there's sort of like this alternate strain of fantasy that's out there that I think is well worth investigating. That sort of trying to push beyond the sort of the medieval European sort of like framework for a high fantasy narrative. So
almost industrialized fantasy.
A little bit. Like, I mean, it's a later chronotopia. It's sort of like, well, in that case, it's about the sort of emergence of industrialization. But like, yeah, like I've heard someone refer to it as manners punk, which I kind of love.
That's yeah. Good. Yeah. I mean, we always need more punk genres.
Yeah, why not?
All right, so I think we're going to wrap this up. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you all for listening.